You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only time we declare a national emergency is when people wear red hats with white text on them, because fuck Arizona Cardinals fans. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you also hate Arizona Cardinal fans, why am I doing the thing against Arizona Cardinal fans right now? I do not know, but if you enjoy your time here in the midside, please tell a friend. That is the best way to get more people listening to our show. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Hello. I knew you'd do it, Justin. Before the show, we were talking about the intro joke, and you had about nine duds. But that was a good one. That was a solid A-minus intro joke. See, I believed in you in the moment that you, with your comedic instincts, would find some punchline to that that would work, but only when you're under pressure.
It's true. Actually, it's 100% true. I sit here all week and I like try to write the intro joke, and I can never come up with a good one till like right before we're recording, and then I say it. So
there you go.
Also, if I ever just want to make a good joke, I just fall back on football. So
there you go. Football, the national joke. Other national jokes include the ongoing Jussie Smollett quote unquote investigation and reporting by the media. We're not going to talk about it in the news this week, per Justin and per me, because we still don't know what the hell's going on. And it's really an indictment of the media here, that we're just constantly reporting leaked sources and unnamed sources and police sources and all these things. There's nothing official. They're not waiting for facts to come out. They just want to spill digital ink all over the page and see what people's eyeballs get attracted to. And it's really, it's kind of sickening, actually.
It's a little bit sickening. Right, 100% it's sickening, and everyone on either side just wants to turn it into some giant case to prove why their collectivist side is correct, and I really just don't want to get involved in any of that. I would rather just talk about what actually happened when we know what actually happened, rather than be like, oh no, he lied about it, or oh no, he didn't lie about it. All MAGA hat wearing people are terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's either, the dichotomy that's being set up is either there is no racism under any circumstances, or all Trump voters are racist and beat up black people.
And put nooses around their neck.
Justin, this sets up perfectly a saying we have on this show.
False dichotomy, bro.
Drink.
That one.
That would have been a good time for a drop, William.
It would have been.
Who?
Do I tell
Who
you
are
how
you
to
talking
do your job?
To?
I haven't been introduced yet.
I don't know who it could be.
But, I mean, Daniel, like, I can prove that all Trump voters aren't racist and aren't out there attacking black people.
Oh.
Can you imagine my parents who voted for Trump, like, putting nooses around random black people's necks?
No, I can't imagine them doing things. So, no.
That's fairly accurate, which proves the point. Yeah. Also joining us this trip, from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his white male gay privilege, and now doing the drops live for the show, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, this it's going to be interesting. I wonder how many weeks it's going to take us to figure out this before we get an official statement from the Chicago police on this Jussie Smollett thing. It's like, everything you listen to, if I listen to folks that tend to, like, in the mainstream media, it's all about how terrible America is, and no one's really waited. Like there's a lot of people that already have egg in their face in this case, and it's, you know, like, obviously this is an example of Trump's America, and then we find out, oh wait, maybe the story isn't exactly true or exactly the way it's presented. Like, even something simple like, did he break his ribs or did he not break his ribs? we don't really know. He was dancing around on stage the next day. Anyone who's broken or bruised a rib knows that's not really a thing. Right after you sustain a rib injury, it's going to be interesting. That any amount of questioning this is seen as immediately racist or homophobic. But since I've checked my gay privilege, I can't really talk about it right now. So
it's true. And if you put egg on your face, that's offensive because that's breakfast face.
Oh no!
We don't condone that here at the Midside.
I forgot. I let go of my privileges. Well, as a woman, I think I can do breakfast face.
It's also things like Jesse has come out and said like he never told the police that they were wearing MAGA hats, and I was trying to figure out where that came from, and I can't actually find the originating source of the MAGA hat wearing thing. They did scream at him like, "This is MAGA country," and other slurs, according to Jesse, if you take him at his breakfast face value. But I can't actually find the source of MAGA hat wearing attackers, which is
interesting. Well, I think the interview he did on Good Morning America is going to be the thing that people come back to. Talk about an actor overacting. I mean, that was some Team America level acting. It was so cringeworthy. So if you want to wonder why people are scratching their heads and doubting the story, I think all you have to do is watch the GMA piece.
That's right. Well, we'll get to some other acting in the news here in a moment. So,
sorry, I'm just hard at work here making a breakfast face T-shirt. All right, let's talk about some of that overacting in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Thanks for everyone for tuning in to The Midside every week. And if you really appreciate what we're doing here, you can go to patreon.com/TheMidside. And give us a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content. Our Patreon page helps us keep the lights on here, and we appreciate all of our Patreon supporters, and that's why we give you exclusive content sometimes. So thanks so much for that. And now to the news. Another actor this week, it seemed to be, was the president, who declared a national emergency about all them Mexicans flooding across the border and taking her gerbs and whatever else all the bad stuff they do.
Wasn't that a South Park episode like 10 years ago?
Yeah. Oh, South Park has been so far ahead of all these trends. It's insane. But Donald Trump in a press briefing about his national emergency may have tipped his hand a little bit about the fact that this may not be an emergency. He handed congressional Democrats, in fact, their quote-unquote opening salvo in the upcoming legal and legislative battles to stymie his declaration of a national emergency at the southern border. This is a quote from Donald Trump. Quote, "I want to do it faster. I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I don't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster." So, that's just Lincoln-level eloquence right there. But those impromptu statements by the president delivered during a White House Rose Garden briefing have in less than 24 hours become Exhibit A in Democratic lawmakers' arguments against what they view as unconstitutional overreach of executive powers by the Trump administration. Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, tweeted out, "He admits it's a hashtag fake Trump emergency. Hear him say it. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster." House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, offered up via Twitter a court transcript of a potential legal challenge to Trump's orders. The court says, "The president said he didn't need to declare an emergency, did he not?" Counsel says, "Correct." The court says, "And that he just did so because he wanted it done faster?" And the counsel says, "Yes, Your Honor." And the court says, "How on earth is that an emergency?" And the counsel says, "Hasn't your time expired?" Very droll, Representative Adam Schiff. So there's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not Trump actually has statutory authority to declare an emergency, whether or not the statute that gives him authority allows this particular kind of emergency. Justin, do you consider you know, whether or not he has legislative authority, we'll get into that in a minute, but whether or not you think he does, is what's going on at the southern border an actual emergency?
That's a really, really, really difficult question, and one of the issues I struggle with the most is immigration. But before we get into all that, if you listen to his quote, he actually, I think, accidentally identified an emergency that no one realizes is an emergency. He's basically complaining that it takes government forever to get things done, and he just wants to get things done quicker. So the real emergency here that he is complaining about is government overreach that makes it impossible to get anything done. So let's suppose for a second that it is a national emergency, or it is a huge threat. Everyone coming over the border and these caravans and so on and so forth. The fact that it's taking so long to get anything done would be a national emergency because of how incompetent government is. So he pointed that out accidentally, which I think is the funniest thing about all of this, is that all of these accidental things are getting pointed out by all these people that they don't even realize it. You watch these two sides yell at each other, and by seeing the subtext of what you're saying, you're realizing how insane the whole system is. But as far as immigration, I'm of two minds of it. And the two minds are, on one hand, I agree with the principle of everybody as a human being should be allowed to go where he or she wants to go. Open borders, let the best make it, let the worst fail, just complete freedom. But the problem is, we don't live in a society of complete freedom. We live in a society where we give everybody everything, and people are brought over and basically created into a voter base for the Democratic Party. So because of the socialist leanings of the country, it then becomes, I don't know if it's whatever the definition of national emergency is, as you said, but it becomes a major, major big deal. I see it here in California. It hurts the culture. It makes the culture worse.
I don't know what that means. I'm going to be honest. I don't know what it means by makes the culture worse. Because I would argue that folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or folks who are born here legally and grew up here like, any social justice leftist makes the culture much worse than illegal immigrants coming here.
Okay, so I'm going to use your buddy Adam Carolla to prove my point because I think he explained this.
Wish it was my
buddy. Yeah. So your podcasting idol, Adam Carolla, I'm going to use him because I think that he explained it the best way possible in freedom. Let's just use free agency as an example. So if you're on a team and they're terrible, and then you go to the Patriots. So actually, let's use Jason McCourty, okay? Jason McCourty as an example. Jason McCourty was on the Browns, Jason McCourty and Danny Shelton. They went 0-16. Then they were on the Patriots this past season, and they won the Super Bowl. Do you think they could effectively contribute to a Super Bowl contender by continuing the same habits, the same style of play, and the same mode of thinking as they did on the 0-16 Browns?
No, of course not.
Right. So what happens when you give these people things, anyone who comes over here, and you tell them they're fine the way they are, is they come over here and they don't change. They recreate the exact same lifestyle they were living where they came from. There's no integration into
the culture. But what is worse, getting two players from another team or a few players from another team who don't fit into your system well and who don't want to fit into your system well, or let's imagine 20% or something, like 10% of the existing Patriots hate the Patriots organization and want them to fail and are trying to take them down from the inside, but you can't get rid of them. I mean, the arguments about the culture are far off base, because in the United States, the culture is made worse by the fact that we have government schools that continue to poorly educate kids. The culture is made worse by the fact that we have crap art. The culture is made worse by the fact that we have a philosophy that's eating us alive from the inside. And I don't think poor Mexicans coming here are making it that much worse than college professors are making it. So if the argument's about the culture, we should be deporting college professors to Mexico or wherever we want in order to make the culture better, which as a reductio ad absurdum, I hope makes clear that I think it's a silly idea to begin with.
Well, you just Jonathan Swift that there very nicely. But I also think you just false dichotomy broad me. I don't disagree with what you're saying. I would say this immigration issue is a cause, it's an effect, not a cause of what you just said.
I think you're falling on the false dichotomy instead of looking at it like head on. Looking at it head on, the issue here is this immigration.
Apply directly to the forehead.
Yeah, this immigration issue is used as a power grab by the Democrats. That's the part that Justin Scott Wright and the part that Daniel Scott Wright is that it really doesn't matter in the sense of the way it's usually argued about on the right. The thing is, the Democrats use it as a issue to excite their base, right? Think of the poor immigrants, right? Like that's sort of the story, the narrative that they have constructed around this. But then
right,
they
don't
end
worry
up
about homelessness and traffic. We're a sanctuary city. We're a sanctuary state.
Exactly. But what they are doing in practice, which the Republicans point out but don't quite understand, is they extend this kind of like benevolent narrative to actual criminals, right? Like in the immigration bill that in the budget in the immigration section, they're limiting the number of beds that can be for folks as they're screening them, right? Like they're preventing people from being deported who've committed violent crimes. These are things that are in the budget bill, right? Like they're extending this to actual people that under a rational immigration policy would be deported. Like there wouldn't be any question about it. And that's the part, because of the narratives on both the left and the right, there's no way that anyone can talk about this without falling into some sort of trap, right? If you start talking about someone like me, I always argue, and I've argued before on the show, like my right to free trade is why I should be able to, you know, have folks come from wherever they want to come from and come to America and engage in trade with me, right? Like that's one of my rights. It doesn't matter where they're from or what border they cross within. You know, we could talk about if we've declared war and things like that. There are certain situations there, but like in general, like the ability for me to assemble and trade with whoever I want means that people should be able to come to this country that aren't criminals or sick or anything else. But once they are a criminal, once they have committed a crime, they don't need to stay. And that's where this whole sanctuary city thing sounds crazy, right? Because it's like, oh, people commit a crime, even violent crimes, and now all of a sudden we're protecting them from deportation. It doesn't make any sense.
All dumb. Agreed. Let's refocus a little bit so that we're not ignoring, because I agree with you, there is a power grab here by the left, but there is literally a power grab here by the right now in the story we're talking about.
Yeah. I have some thoughts on that.
Don't get me wrong. The left is... All the left wants is more power. I get that. But the right in this case is, and the president in particular, is using this as some sort of power grab under the false pretense of a national emergency. One of the things he talks about is all the crime and drugs. But as I was shocked the other day when I was reading that 80% or more, and this is 80% of like the most hardcore drugs, but up to 90% of like marijuana coming from Mexico, 80% or more of all legal drugs coming across the southern border come through existing checkpoints. 80% or more come through existing checkpoints. So the 20% or less that are coming through the various areas, I don't think this constitutes an emergency. I don't think this constitutes either the actual epistemological definition of an emergency, i.e. something that's happening immediately that we have very little time to respond to that's overwhelming us, or the legal definition of an emergency, which has longstanding precedent in the United States and was in fact codified into actual law in 1976 under the Emergency Act or something silly like that. It has some stupid on-the-nose name. But the point of which was to tell the president, you can declare an emergency, but it basically has to be something that Congress has no time to respond to. basically that something that, and not Congress hasn't responded to because they've either chosen to or have been unwilling to do, but something Congress doesn't literally have the time to respond to. Like, it happens immediately and there needs to be an action. Then the president can declare an emergency and it has to be renewed every single year. So what Trump is doing is picking out something that that people have not been able to persuade members of Congress to act on either side, and saying it's an emergency because I decide this is an important priority. No, absolutely not. That is a violation of separation of powers. That is him taking on legislative powers. This should be not only struck down by Congress, the court should slap him down. And as far as I'm concerned, he should come under articles of impeachment, not be removed, but certainly be censured for declaring an emergency when it's in fact not an emergency. That is an abuse of his power and an abuse of the presidency.
Two things. One, isn't that just what you just described, a result of our culture? Isn't he just acting as a relativist subjectivist? Oh, well, I think this is an emergency, and based on my definition of emergency, I'm going to declare an emergency. And two, didn't he run his entire campaign on the platform of I'm going to talk about a border wall and a quote-unquote immigration problem to grab power?
He did, but you can't – I mean, talking about it and doing it are two different things. He can talk about it all he wants. He can use it as a cudgel.
I'm not defending him. He can use it as a threat. I'm just saying this is not unexpected. I mean, say what you will about the man. Like, he said he's going to build a wall, and he's trying to build a fucking wall. Like,
I get that. He's very on point.
Yeah. It was just different for a politician. So, like
– if you took that one element of Belichick, you know, we're onto the wall. We're onto the wall. We're onto the wall. Like, I get that part of it. He's trying to appease his base because he's never going to win re-election if he doesn't appease his base. But the way he's going about it is total, absolute, unconstitutional nonsense, in my opinion. And not only is it unconstitutional, it's, to use the word from last week, immoral, because he's doing something that is outside of the scope of what he as an executive should be allowed to do. Period. You know, whether or not the courts or whomever will agree with that, I don't know, because the original Emergency Act, I still can't find the exact name, it's something really dumb, had a provision in it that would allow Congress to basically say it's not an emergency with a joint resolution of Congress, which isn't legislation, it's just a, like, hear kind of thing.
Oh, but I thought the joint resolution was when they all smoked weed and came to a decision.
It's probably better. Probably would be better overall. But the Supreme Court struck that down in the 80s as a separation of powers issue, because basically they said once you've given the president a power, you can't decide to take it away from him without law, so you got to pass a law, which makes it harder. It was the 1976 National Emergencies Act. I told you it was very on the nose. So I don't know. This is all craziness to me. Maybe I'll get your feedback on the smaller point of, do you think this sets a really bad precedent for the future, that something that to me is not an actual emergency can be used through this legal mechanism to essentially legislate? Do you think that other presidents will use this inappropriately in the future if there's a precedent set here?
Nah, that would never happen.
I don't know, guys. I got a hot take here. I think this is a historic opportunity. This could be the crowning achievement of the Trump presidency, the reigning in of executive power. Think about this. We had
it's a president. It's the 4D chess argument. Here we go.
Well, no. No, it's not. It's something different.
Oh,
When Obama issued all these executive orders, there were a lot of conservatives who were up in arms. They were like, this is the frequency and amount of power grab by the executive has been accelerating, and this was getting out of hand. You have some of those same voices on the right now standing up against this move by Trump. If those Republicans and the completely irrational, whatever Trump says, I'm doing the opposite, Democrats can get together and actually make a consistent argument for separation of powers, we could see the pendulum start to swing the other way. That's something positive that could come out of this. So in other words, could this be the pinnacle of executive power grab, where we start to rein the executive back in, where people on both sides of the aisle realize that just because my guy is in office in the presidency that I don't have to support them. This is not what the founders imagined, right? The founders did not imagine that Congress would side with the executive because they were the same party. They thought they would be jealous for their own power, right? And if we can stoke some of that jealousy again, then maybe we can have the pendulum start to swing the other way and limit the power of the presidency.
And to be clear, you're not saying. Oh, sorry. It's your show.
You lost me at actually make a consistent argument.
Well, you have folks. You have Ted Cruz out there making the argument. You have Lindsey Graham out there making the argument. So this isn't.
Well, I'll tell you the argument they're making.
When did Lindsey Graham become awesome? Anyway, continue, Daniel.
So two things, William. One, I want to clarify. You're not saying that this is a 4D Trumpian move to limit executive power.
No,
you're just saying this will be a result of his insanity.
Yeah, his incompetence could lead to something good.
The whole wall thing people are saying is just all a giant gambit from the time he started his campaign to undermine executive power. That's what people are saying.
No, I don't think people are saying that. I was wondering if William was saying that, would be the next. That would be 44D.
I don't think he's doing this I don't think he's doing this on purpose at all. I think that this is a opportunity. If you had to tell me how we would limit executive power, like what would be a circumstance, I would tell you it would be a Democrat controlled House and a Republican president. Why? Because the Democrats would never support it on their own, right? They would never support limiting executive power on their own. But when you have this, as long as we can use their hatred of Trump for something, let's use it for this. This is a great opportunity to use their hatred for Trump to bring us back to a real respect for the Constitution and separation of powers.
Yeah, it's interesting. Justin, the argument I see some of the more principled Republicans making, it ranges from this is clearly unconstitutional to something like this may be legal. Technically, it may be legal. We don't know, but technically it may be legal, or it looks like it may be legal. But nonetheless, we should act to do something to rein in this kind of executive order. Do you have any hope that the Republicans and the Democrats could get together to do, I don't know, order a milkshake or do any chocolate or vanilla, you know?
You took the punchline out of my mouth. I don't think they could get together to like go to McDonald's. Like,
yeah,
it's just, I mean, this is the country where wasn't there like a softball practice where like Republicans got shot or something? Like,
yeah,
it's not gonna happen. Like, the Republicans could be like, I want to go. I think
if there's one thing Republicans and Democrats can unite around, it's their hatred of Trump. You have a huge base of Never Trumpers in the Republican Party, and a lot of them in Congress. And this is the one opportunity. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm just saying that this is the positive way out. This is what we should be rooting for.
All right. Well, we're not going to get anyone to agree on that.
Build that wall. No, don't build that wall, please. Don't waste my money.
Such a Keynesian nonsense waste of money. So no one can agree on that. But one thing we can agree on is that this Connecticut minor league baseball team are a bunch of jackasses. Cracker jackasses, in fact. A minor league baseball team in Connecticut has decided that they will now be banning peanuts and Cracker Jacks from its premises. The ballpark is one of the first professional sports venues to ban the popular snacks because of their allergic properties and how deadly they are, especially among young children. What's next, Justin? Banning apple pie and baseball?
I was going to say they have to ban Take Me Out to the Ball Game now, right? Because it's false advertising.
Yeah, you can't even sing it. Buy me some kale and more kale chips or something. Like, I don't know what you do.
Based on this principle, shouldn't they just ban baseball? I mean, there are so many things that go on at a baseball game. This is the arrogance of social engineering that I'll never understand. Like, people are like, oh yeah, we're going to make things better by banning peanuts. That was really, like, when you look at the number one threats to people or the biggest threats to people's comfort at baseball games, that was what you came up with. You did an intensive study and you were like, oh yeah, that's the peanuts. and the Cracker Jacks. Yeah, let's just throw the Cracker Jacks in there. Like,
they go together.
I mean, that's your number one threat, right? It's not like the people who are too big and take up the seats next to you. It's not the people who spill the beer on you. It's not the terrible play on the field. It's the peanuts. That's the problem. It's just...
Well, I was going to say, William, I don't know where you stand on this, but it would seem to me that if they were going to ban something that's actually dangerous, and maybe peanuts are on the list, I don't know, things that are actually dangerous.
Beer!
I would suspect that alcohol kills or injures far more people at sporting events than peanuts do.
How about it's literally just poison you're pouring into your system?
Well, look, I like beer. Thank you. I do concede that some people, in fact, maybe many people, can't really handle it very well and thus get aggressive or poison themselves or drive drunk.
Wait, you're talking about peanuts?
Yes. When the people are just huffing peanut dust and getting high at baseball games. So, William, what do you think? I know, have you expressed some sympathy in the past for banning peanuts in various places?
I'm okay with peanut-free zones. I'm not sure if the entire baseball stadium must be peanut-free. I'm not sure that that's the right solution.
Wait. So we have peanut-free zones. We have cigarette-free zones. Are we just going to be sitting in a section now based upon our dietary needs and biological needs and preferences?
Well, you
so
know, we see
sitting
we
in
see
the bleachers
increasing...
by myself in the straight-edge section? Like, that's the reductio ad absurdum of this.
Well, you know, we see this happening across all sorts of consumer goods where people want personalized things. I'm not sure how far you can take that into the baseball stadium, but you're going to see people try to do this. I mean, look at what's baseball attendance the last few years? And this is a minor league team, right? Like, how this has to be a move to try and like bring in like the huge peanut allergic children audience. Like, I don't know, like, that they're desperate for anything to try and personalize services to bring in those consumers. So
I have the
maybe
perfect
the
solution
circus
for this.
Could ban peanuts next, because I think the two places people who are allergic to peanuts want to go is the circus and minor league baseball games
and Texas Roadhouse.
Good one.
And Five Guys.
I have the perfect solution for people who want a incredibly personalized experience where there's no peanuts, there's no alcohol, there's no smoking. You get a luxury seat. You get it to experience the game in beautiful high definition. It's called your living room. Stop going out. If you need things to be this well sanitized for you, stop going out. If a peanut 97 rows below you is going to send you into anaphylactic shock, you may not be able to go outside. Sorry, your life sucks. Your parents should have eaten peanuts while they were pregnant. The end. Okay.
Now remember that I'm done, people used to be in bubbles and we like made movies about people who were in bubbles and how it was crazy to be in bubbles and try to live like Bubble Boy. They did the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and everything to make fun of it. And they had earlier ones about it too.
Yeah. Boy in the Bubble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now that's
now
real.
It's real.
Yeah.
Nothing is so absurd that it won't eventually become reality. The Midside Law. Speaking of, the Boy Scouts organization inaugurates its first all-girls troops. Yes, this is, of course, happening in my backyard. Washington, D.C. marked the end and the beginning of an era this weekend when the Boy Scouts of America established its first all-girl troops
How
in the
nation's
capital. How
dare you assume their gender?
I know. How did they know? Now it's, of course, now known as Scouts BSA. The organization, which celebrated its 109th birthday on Friday, has begun welcoming girls in a rebranding effort amid dwindling membership, sex abuse scandals, and criticism from the equally venerable Girl Scouts of the USA.
Oh, good idea. There's sex abuse scandals, so let's just introduce the other half of young people to this organization.
That's right. That'll fix it. At least it won't be gay sex abuse. Okay. In the district, nearly 30 troops, with an estimated 200 girls, took the Scout Pledge on Saturday. Across the country, thousands of girls have entered the scouting program since Friday, becoming eligible to achieve the rank of Eagle Scout, a distinction that signifies years of participation and success in leadership, civic duty, and self-reliance. Craig Burkhart, the scoutmaster for the district's newly formed Scouts BSA Troop 248 said, "Our goal is to help families instill confidence and good judgment in these young girls." Justin, I'll take a radical position on this. Is this really that bad? Is it really, you know, I mean, I get the farce of it. I get the farce of the Boy Scouts are now letting in girls, but they've rebranded now. They're just Scouts BSA. Is this really that bad?
Well, ultimately, it's just like sort of a marketing ploy. It's what you said. They have dwindling participation, and they're like, hey, we have half the market out here that we haven't taken advantage of. We need more money, so why don't we just open up to half the market? But yeah. There's an interesting question here to me about a business and what the purpose of your business is and your business's identity and shifting that to make a profit, and if profits are your only bottom line. So they were created as the Boy Scouts.
Yes.
Presumably they believed, based on principle, there was value to having an organization for only boys to go to develop into young men. Away from girls, women, all of that sort of thing. Just like with Girl Scouts, they presumably believed there was a value to them developing away from boys and men and all of that sort of thing. So then if you go against that in order just to make a profit, what does that say about you? What does that say about culture? What does that say about society? I get it. I get it from a money-making standpoint. I get it. But should money be the sole determinant here? Because that's what it seems like. It seems like they were just like, we can make money by selling this to the other half of people. Let's do it.
I'll quasi-respond, but basically toss it over to William, which is that, you know, maybe it's not an issue of should and an issue of had to, in the sense of, William, do you think it's mostly because of the changing cultural norms around boys and masculinity that the Scouts had to do this in order to exist, basically?
Yeah, I think you've kind of like hit the nail on the head with that, because we see, on its own, like, it's not really a big deal, right? Like, sure. But when you look at the larger culture that we have right now, we're very hostile to boys. We basically give boys, we call it attention deficit disorder, male behavior, and put them on drugs. We have no boys-only spaces. We have no consideration of a positive view of masculinity, right? Basically, we define positive masculinity as being as woman-like as possible, right? And we don't have any we have a crisis, right, in trying to develop real masculine men and really understanding how boys in general learn differently than girls, right? And how activities and male bonding is a thing that boys need to have in order to become healthy, functioning men. And if that was their mission, I could definitely see where someone would say they've betrayed it by expanding their market to include women. At the same time, like, here's what we'll see in the next step. If we start seeing the kinds of the values and the criteria and the system that is the Boy Scouts start to become more about to become more feminized, right? To bring in more of the militant feminist culture, then we'll know that it's the end. And this is just delaying the inevitable for a thing like the Boy Scouts. You can't fight this cultural trend by giving up the thing that makes you unique. Like, they are bigger than the Girl Scouts right now, but I know the Girl Scouts say, why do we need the Girl Scouts if the Boy Scouts are accepting girls? I look at it the other way around. Why do we need the Boy Scouts, right? If the Girl Scouts already does what the Boy Scouts are going to become.
Right. I'm glad you culminated in that, William, because I agreed with everything you were saying about the problem. And I was going to say, you know, we have identified this problem, and it seems like the best thing to do is get rid of the boys-only organization that addresses this problem.
Yeah, that's exactly the argument that they've accepted implicitly. I don't think they've done it on purpose, right? I don't think they've taken on their destruction on purpose, right? But this is what is the result, is they've ensured the destruction of the Boy Scouts.
And the market has I don't know if it's spoken or if you respond to it or what you do or if you change your mission or you make your mission more narrow or what you do. But I was looking at the numbers. The Boy Scouts are down more than half of their membership from the peaks in the 1970s. So clearly something in the culture has changed in how they respond to this organization, and the organization is picking something to do in response, but unclear if that's the correct thing to do. I think waiting it out and seeing is the right approach here. But you know who didn't wait it out to see was Amazon. They booked it out of New York City before they could even get a shovel into the dirt. Yes, Amazon announced this week that they would be pulling out of their plans to have half of their new regional office in New York. The other half, of course, will be located in Northern Virginia. Can't wait. Just what we need. More people. Can't wait. But in the press statement, they basically said, after much thought and deliberation, we've decided not to move forward with our plans to build a headquarters for Amazon in Long Island City, Queens. When it became clear that a number of state and local politicians oppose our presence. So this was basically a grassroots-ish of sorts campaign by the public to stop Amazon from moving in, and it worked. Of course, this means that the city of New York will no longer have to shell out $1.5 billion in incentives to Amazon in exchange for creating 25,000 jobs and $2.5 billion in investment from the company. But the article from The Verge basically says that that Amazon got New York City wrong, you know, the entire time. The subheading of this story by Casey Newton says, a promise of 25,000 jobs isn't exciting anymore. It's ominous. And the point of this article is that the jobs we're talking about, the situation Amazon is proposing, is not one where people are going to get really quality jobs and have a good, meaningful life. It's either going to be jobs that local New Yorkers are not qualified for and thus could not get and will never see, or it's going to be really low-paying crap jobs like janitor and barista and stuff that people don't really want and that have no future in. So the article goes to say that essentially Amazon and the current economic culture is creating two classes of people. A group of well-educated professionals who enjoy good jobs with rising wages, and a much lower-paid group of service industry workers who take care of them. Justin, any reaction to either part of that, either the latter part about the two working groups or the former part about Amazon pulling out because of public pressure?
Well, I think Amazon should know that the pullout method never works, so they're not going to achieve their goal here of not impregnating the public with hate for Amazon by pulling out.
You're saying in 9 months we're still going to have a little headquarters in New York, if they like it or not?
We're still going to hate them even more in 9 months than we did before is what's going to happen.
Oh, gotcha. A little hate baby.
In 9 months, it's just going to be like an anger baby in New York, especially in New York, right? I mean, that's what happens every 9 months. A baby's born and it's very angry. As far as the class thing, dude, like, I don't have an answer to this. I mean, South Park did their season finale on this, and I think they did it well, but I don't know. It's just one of those where it's like, I don't live in this world that they're talking about. Like, where is this fucking world where because you have a degree and you have 2 degrees or multiple degrees or good degrees, you make a shitload of money? And where is this other world where a service industry, or the other part of it, where a service industry job is terrible and not something you can make a career off of? Like, if you work in a service industry, right, and you start as a waiter, can't you conceivably work your way up to manager and then conceivably save enough money to open your own place and then have your own restaurant? And isn't that a great job? Like, that's a respectable, worthwhile job you could have for life.
Yeah,
like,
that requires ambition.
Well, I think there's another thing. There's another side of this, too. I've seen this characterized in a different way that I think would be a good thing to discuss. So, like, someone like me and I think all of us on the show, actually, we live in a world where we are willing to move where there are opportunities. There's a whole class, quote unquote, I'm using that in a loose word here, of people who do not move to meet those economic opportunities for whatever reason, right?
They don't move for whatever reason. In this country.
That's why this, you know, when they're talking about, for the anxious public, a promise of $25,000 new jobs sounds much different in 2019 than 2009. If you're among the sea of hotel and restaurant workers that Porter describes, you know you're likely never going to be qualified for one of the jobs that Amazon is creating in your backyard. So what? Move. Right? Like, is this, am I an elitist for thinking that? I remember being in high school, getting ready for college and thinking, like, I will be a complete failure if I live in Michigan after, you know, after I graduate college, right? Like,
yeah.
Not because I didn't maybe want to live in Michigan someday, right? At that point, I hadn't really decided, but I was like, it would be a complete failure for me to stay in this place, given the, you know, declining at that time, the hugely declining automotive industry, which was the main thing there. The only thing that was growing was health and elderly care in Michigan. I was like, I don't, you know, there's places where there are better opportunities and I need to go check those out.
It's not only that, William, but it's things, there's two things here I want to say about this. One, you may not be qualified for one of the 25,000 jobs that Amazon is specifically creating, but the economic boom that sort of thing brings a lot of other potential industries that are quote-unquote service jobs, but don't have to be service jobs in the typical way. It could be coming up with a new type of app to serve people in the cities, or it could be coming a new product.
Are you telling them hashtag learn the code? Because that'll get you banned from...
I would never use those hate words, William. That is... What do you think of me? My God. But there's any number of things. But then, secondly, I want to put this in a tiny bit of historical context that we don't hear about a lot anymore, which is, so you have a job as a waiter or a job at Starbucks, and it's not the most glamorous job in the world, but it pays the bills, and maybe you don't have a lot of upside to it, but you could be ambitious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, let's take this back 100 years. What are you doing? I mean, what is your low-level job look like 100 years ago?
Starbucks,
how about
right?
200 years ago?
Starbucks?
Like, you're not mining for coal. You're not subsistence farming. You know, you're not nearly starving to death on a daily basis. You're living, you know, in a rent controlled apartment on the Upper East Side with a roommate, and you have a high def 70-inch TV and a PlayStation. And yeah, your life's not all that grand, but you're not a coal miner. You're not dying of black lung disease. Like, let's put this in historical context. Maybe you don't like your job, but throughout human history, there have been way worse situations for most human beings.
Well, was there more or less peanut dust 200 years ago at the baseball stadium?
You had to literally scrape a mountain of peanut dust off your seat in order to sit down.
Wow. Daniel, yeah. Tell me more, Papa Daniel.
I know, dude, I've read a history book, so I sound like an old person, but
it's another side of the same argument I was making, is by creating this dichotomy, this false dichotomy, bro, they're living in a comparative society. Yeah, of course, like, you know, if I look at Tom Brady and I go, well, it's not fair that I don't have the life Tom Brady has, I'm going to be like sad about my own life. But do I live every day thinking about all the other jobs and all the other money and all the other things people have? Or do I think about what I value and what I'm good at and the best way to maximize what I can do based upon what exists?
Yes, this whole article is a second-handed approach to work, a second-handed approach to living.
Yes.
Of course you're going to be miserable if you judge yourself exclusively by other people and everything that is outside of you. Stop it. Here's your solution. Stop doing that. Ta-da, the end.
To be fair, there is another thing here. Look, managing a movie theater, I think, is a great job. If somebody really enjoys that, I could see doing that. But how do you do that in a California or New York City? The governments have made it so these people are so priced out of having these type of jobs, and that's part of the problem.
Well, of course, and you have to be willing to move. If people are willing to move, then things will have to change, because you won't be able to have people to do these service jobs. The price will have to be raised, and people will make better money to do these service jobs. The point is, there has to be competition. And for there to be competition, you yourself need to be competitive. You need to be able to move and take opportunities in other places. You need to be able to give up something of a lower value, like the you know, the quasi rent controlled apartment you have that has a, you know, a sliver view of the ocean, and be able to move inland to a place with a crappier view, but a cheaper apartment where you can get a job and save some money and build some capital for your life. But people don't ever think of it that way. They think of, like, well, why should I have to move? I want to live where I want to live and get a paying job that pays me $1 million a year and have a supermodel girlfriend and be the Super Bowl MVP 4 times. Damn it. Otherwise, the world is unfair and we should eat all the capitalists.
So, right, Daniel, on top of that, I have a question for you. Is this article a worse take than Ocasio-Cortez saying that she's going to use the money from the tax breaks to fix the subways in New York?
I've just determined that when she speaks, it's just that noise the Roadrunner makes. It's just meep meep, and then that's all I hear.
She seriously,
the adults and peanuts.
I know it's not in this story, but she seriously was tweeting long Twitter rants when Amazon announced they were pulling out, that, well, finally we can use the tax cut or the tax rebate. Sorry. That Amazon was going to enjoy to fix the subway and a bunch of other things, feed the children and all this other stuff. And I don't think anyone explained to her that they were now going to get zero, right? They were going to get, you know, 60% of the taxes, and she was going to use that 40% that they were not going to charge Amazon. But now they're just getting zero now. So I don't know how she's going to fix the subways.
And it should not go without saying, though, that, you know, tax breaks are one thing. You know, taking less of the money you're stealing from this company anyway is one thing, even though it does create some unfair advantages. I understand that some libertarians are against it, etc. But if New York is giving them any positive benefits, like building, you know, specific bus routes for them or trains or, you know, whatever it is, any positive benefits, I don't think cities should be doing that. That is not a legitimate function of government, to be positive, giving some positive incentive to a company to come to move in. But I have no problem with tax breaks because it's just money being stolen from them anyway.
So, Daniel, to go back to what you were saying before about the second-handed approach to business and life and everything, another way that's done is by creating the perception that these places are the ideal places to live, as if there's something intrinsic about California, there's something intrinsic about New York City that makes it better to live in. Nobody asks the question, what's the best place to live for you? It's just, oh, I'm going to live in California because it's the best place to live. I'm going to live in New York City because it's the best city in the world. And they have this perception that that intrinsically these are the best. And that's part of why these people stay there, because they don't want to give that up because, oh, they already live in the best place. If they can just get the best things in the best place.
Yeah.
Dale's Lawn is the best place to live for me.
It is not the best
right
place.
Now.
Oh, it's all crap. So.
All right, well, let's talk about some things that aren't crap in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off. When I wasn't focused on last episode, I plugged a analytical live stream with Midsider Katrina about M. Night Shyamalan's films, and that stream has become two streams. So we did part one this past Saturday, and we talked about all of his movies. We talked about the cultural context. We talked about the journey of his career. That's up on her YouTube channel right now. I'm also going to link to it in this episode on the midside.com/podcast. And next Saturday, same bat time, same bat channel, Saturday at noon Pacific time. So that's what time, Daniel? 3 p.m. Eastern time?
Something like that. What did you say? Sorry, I was doing research for this section.
No, I was just talking about when I'm going to be doing Easter. The M. Night stream, the part two. Part two, we're going to be doing a deep dive into Glass. So if you enjoy the mid-side episodes where we analyze, we did a lot of Patreon-exclusive deep dives into movies before. That is what I will be doing with Midsider Katrina next Saturday at noon on her channel, and I will link to that. If you're a Patreon subscriber, I sent the Patreon subscribers the link ahead of time this past week. Also invited them to listen to the live stream of our episode via Discord. So get up on Patreon if you want to be able to do that. And also, I'll put it on Twitter and I'll put it on Facebook. So be on the lookout for that. And actually, one of the topics we talked about was sequels. And I know, Daniel, you're all the time talking about how most sequels aren't warranted. Will come up here in Trailer Takedown, actually. But it also came up in a movie that I saw yesterday. I saw Happy Death Day to You. Now, as everyone knows, if you listen to this show quite frequently, I loved the first Happy Death Day. It was a nice little hit there. It was a surprise little hit. It had a surprising amount of thematic depth to it. And it was a horror movie that wasn't a slasher. It wasn't focused on gore. So it was a very benevolent movie. It was very much about learning how to live better and become a better person and have a better life. And it didn't use the word selfish, but it was properly selfish in that way. Well, Happy Death Day to You is a sequel that's unwarranted, but welcome. So in this movie, they essentially decided, what if we did Happy Death Day again, but we did it in a way to explain why the time loop happened in the first time? So this movie becomes ridiculous. It's just absolutely absurd. And Midsider Michael was texting me about it, and he said that people have described it as ambitious and ridiculous. And I think those two words accurately describe it. But the nice thing about it is, even though it's a new writer-director, he did not go against the tone and go against what made the first one good. There is still the philosophical, psychological, thematic core. I sound so pretentious right now, but that core of the
right
movie.
Now.
Right.
Your nose is actually touching the ceiling in your apartment right now. That's
that made the first movie worthwhile. It was that depth, that it wasn't just about the time loop and that she kept dying over and over again. It was that she went on a journey where she learned things. And the same thing happens here. So the time loop ends up repeating again. There's parallel universes involved here. They didn't go as far as that as I would have liked, but that's probably because I'm a sci-fi nerd. But she learned something, and she learned something different, which makes her an even better person than the first one. And it's really well done in the fact that she learns it. So I think you should see this movie if you just want to see what can be done in the horror genre nowadays. It's not, it's just like the first one. It's not gory. It's not bloody. It's not over the top with violence. It's horror because the idea of having to live the same day over and over again, where there's people trying to kill people, there's a serial killer that gets loud on the loose. All of these, it's just a horrific premise psychologically. But don't see this movie if you want a secret sci-fi sequel, because this is really a secret sci-fi sequel. I mean, it's like almost an episode of Next Generation at this point. Remember the episode of Next Generation, guys, where Worf is jumping between the parallel universes?
Yeah,
it very much could have become that if they wanted it to. I was disappointed it didn't. Also, don't see it if you're immature. So the reason I say this is, and this is probably the starkest statement on our culture I can make, and just demonstrating the way things are. So they had this whole premise and they were doing it. And then at a certain point, there was the really emotional conversation, which gave the movie its worth, right? If this main character, Teresa, didn't have this emotional core, have this moment in the movie, the rest of the movie would have been meaningless. It would have just been purely surface level, purely pragmatic. Pragmatic in the sense of, here's a premise, she's going to go through the premise, and we're going to watch her going through the premise. But there's nothing that she learns that then her learning that can demonstrate to us what we can learn and take from her journey. And while she's having this conversation, there were literally people in the back of the theater yelling for her to shut up. And for the other person in the conversation with her to shut up. They were going, shut up, this is terrible, gay. And I had to tell myself, do not escalate this situation, because I wanted to turn around and tell them that they were ruining the movie and to please shut the fuck up, because some of us are trying to enjoy the entire movie, not just the killings.
Were you going to slip the please in there?
Yeah, I was going to slip the please in there, yes.
Okay.
So I think this is worth seeing, especially if you enjoyed the first one, but I know Daniel's probably never going to see it, so
nope.
Whatever. Let's talk about some other things that Daniel may or may not see. I don't know. We're going to find out because we're going to talk about some trailers here. And as always, the trailer takedown preview is usually posted on Saturdays now on the website. And if you go there, you can watch ahead of time all the trailers. You can watch it after we talk about them. You can watch them during. You can alternate. You know, we talk about one, you watch it. We talk about when you watch it, or vice versa. You watch it, we talk about it. That's at themidside.com/podcast.
Trailer takedown. First
Frozen
trailer.
Two. Okay, that's my bad, everyone. So, sorry. Good job, William. I fucked that one up.
It was only a matter of time.
What were you going to say, William?
First trailer.
Okay, we did it again. All right. I'm probably just going to leave that in there because it's funny. But, yeah, I fucked that up. I'm not quite used to William doing the drops yet. So
I know. He's losing control of his own podcast. It's great.
The worst part is I got to give you more Patreon money now because you're doing more. It's a joke. I will gladly give you more money because you're improving the show very, very much, and I appreciate it. So thank you, William, for the great job you're doing. Sorry I messed up. Honestly, the reason I messed up is I just wanted to, like, just rail on this trailer so terribly. You want to talk about a sequel that doesn't need to be made, Daniel? Are we just, like, now Elsa's becoming a superhero? Is that what Frozen 2 is? Like, they realized they gave her superpowers, and they were like, yeah, let's just make this a superhero origin movie. I will say that makes it more interesting than the first one, but also I don't need this to ever be made. Tackle.
Tackle.
Weird. So the first Frozen is sort of a lighthearted, but it has a sort of quasi-serious message, and it gets, like many Disney or Pixar movies, has adult themes that done in a way that children can handle. So it's fine. It's perfectly fine movie. I thought it was good. It's hard to tell what is going to take off and be mega successful in the way that Frozen was. And if you had put 100 movies in front of me and Frozen was one of them, I wouldn't have picked it out as one that would be wildly successful. But the sequel looks incongruent with the first movie. So it opens on this quasi realistic but very dark and dreary ocean, and then it cuts to, like, the sprite-faced, chubby-faced, smush-faced Elsa, and the animation is so disparate that I actually let out a laugh. Like, it actually looked like a visual joke to me that they went from this naturalistic, dark, ominous ocean cut to this pixie-like face of her trying to look determined. And I thought it was a joke. It wasn't. The whole trailer is this way.
Daniel, adding to the joke is it was basically just a redo of the scene from the first Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire where he's trying to learn how to use his powers as she tries to, like, surf on the waves with her water or frozen powers.
Yeah, and it's so dark, like, both literally and figuratively. It's so depressing. It's so ominous. And you compare that to the animation style of the characters, and you wonder what the hell is going on. And the way they were all, like, traveling in a pack, and there were swords and horses, and it just looked like Lord of the Ice Rinks or something. Like, like, what the hell are they doing with
setting
this?
Setting up the next trailer, huh?
Yes. Yes, thank you. I don't know. This was a teaser as much as it was a trailer, because we don't actually hear anyone speak either, so we don't know what the real plot is. And they discover autumn. They go to a place that has autumn, and I don't know how the snowman survives in a place that's how it ended, right? They discover a place that has fall.
I don't know
what they're doing.
It, to be honest.
So this is a light tackle for me.
Didn't they do a whole summer thing with him?
Tackle
with Olaf. They did a whole summer thing. I thought.
How does he? I guess he's magical, so it doesn't matter. But. Whatever, dumb. William?
I thought this was a joke trailer when I first watched it. Because you guys aren't underselling how different the trailer is from the original Frozen movie. Like, you pointed out the animation difference, but the music, the sort of, like, framing, like, I don't know if I was getting the superhero vibe, but more like a suspense thriller vibe. Like, is this like Die Hard in the Frozen universe? Like, I don't know what this is. This doesn't make
any
sense.
You guys are doing a better job of selling this movie than the trailer is. I am so down for a satire of Frozen that's also a Die Hard movie. Like, that, like, that's a perfect premise.
I thought it was a joke. I thought this was someone doing a joke. I can't believe it.
I get where William is coming from, because I could imagine this being exactly the same if you had said, like, someone cut the original Frozen trailer but as a horror movie, for instance.
Yeah. I thought this was a suspense thriller horror. That's exactly where I thought this was going. So yeah.
I will watch suspense thriller horror Frozen, just to be clear.
But to be clear, I had to watch the first one like 97,000 times because my friend's daughter was just at that right age, that Frozen age, when it came out. So I am no way subjecting myself to this movie on those grounds alone. But if it's a suspense horror thriller, even less. So tackle.
What if they remix the song Let It Go, and that's what the killer sings to people as their life is slowly draining out of them?
As long as Eminem is the one who does the version, then I'm all down. Then I'll change my mind.
This is the greatest movie ever written by us. I am so in for this movie. Hug.
You're not getting that.
Oh, come on.
No. No hugging fake movies.
Second trailer.
Tolkien is another one in the series of biographical movies. That'd be impressive. I'd be really
Whoa,
impressed.
We're going back to Death Day. There's a time loop.
Yeah,
Tolkien writes his own movie.
I'd be down for that. I would hug that in a moment. No, this is another one of those biographical movies where it's like, hey, did you know he also wrote a book when World War I was going on? Oh, and we're going to have Nicholas Holt, the guy who played Beast, play him. Oh, and we're going to say the word fellowship at the end of the trailer. So you're going to want to see it because you're going to remember this is the guy who wrote Lord of the Rings. Oh, and also we're going to use the same animation for the word Tolkien as when we did for all of the Lord of the Rings movie titles. This just seems like a cash grab. They're like, hey, who else can we do a biographical film of? This just makes me really, really sad that the only semi-biographical film we got of Ayn Rand was, what was it, The Spirit of Ayn Rand or whatever the fuck that movie was with Helen Mirren?
I don't even remember.
You know what I'm talking about, like, though, right?
Wasn't it called, like, Ayn Rand in Love or something weird?
Yeah, Ayn Rand and unnecessarily sexualizing her in a negative way. Yeah, so tackles all around.
Tackle.
Look, I think Tolkien's life story is probably interesting. I'm just not so sure it's interesting for a movie. And to Justin's point, if you were going to say, I have to hit 50 cliches about Tolkien in 2 minutes for a trailer, what should I do? This trailer hit 140 out of 200, I think.
Bingo! Yahtzee!
Probably tackle.
Tackle.
You know, I'm a pretty big Tolkien fan. That was the first like super long book I ever read was The Hobbit. In fifth grade, I started reading through The Lord of the Rings. So you'd think this would be something for me, but I'm not interested in seeing this at all. This movement of like fictionalized biographies when a documentary would do much more justice is just not something I'm into. So I get a chance to use the one that's marked as Balrog here. I'm going to tackle.
Tackle.
Aesthetically integrated.
Finally had a use for that. He made that like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, well, I can't believe it finally lined up here that we could actually use it.
Third trailer.
Yesterday is a British film with a very interesting premise. So there's a world blackout, which I think wasn't there a show about that? Like everyone like blacks out for a minute. I forget what it was called years ago. But anyway, there's a world blackout in the sense that all the power goes out and I think all the people pass out. And when they all wake up, there's one guy who's a struggling singer-songwriter who is the only one who remembers the Beatles. So he starts acting like he wrote the Beatles songs, because nobody knows otherwise. And he becomes very, very famous based upon this. There's a lot of really interesting implications to this premise. I think they kind of deal with it. There seems to be one point where he says, I'm in a very complicated situation, because he knows he didn't write the songs, but he's still getting popular off of them. So it looks like they could be using this premise in a worthwhile way. And this doesn't look like it's just a cheesy romantic comedy or anything like this. It looks like there's actual depth to the character journeys. So I love the creativity of this premise. I think the acting looks strong. The directing didn't look particularly creative, but based upon the writing and the premise and the acting, this is a big hug for me. I think this looks really interesting.
First trailer.
Oh, that was me this time.
Nope.
Hug.
Nope.
This is the first trailer I hugged. That's correct.
Time loop. I agree with Justin in the sense that it is particularly interesting to me when people can take a very, very simple premise and create a world out of it and create a whole timeline and character and development and like actually explore the consequences of either removing one thing from reality or inserting one thing into reality. It's almost like good science fiction. This is definitely not a science fiction movie, but it's almost what a good science fiction movie does. So I like that. I think the acting looks strong. At this really stupid moment watching like 2.5 minutes in the trailer where I was like bobbing my head and I was like, man, this movie has really good music. I was like, oh right.
You bought into the premise of the movie. That's great. That's called suspending.
Oh, I felt so dumb at the end.
Suspending disbelief. Yeah. That's what's going on there.
Yeah. So this is because there's some ways that they could make this really terrible at the end and make it about sort of unearned success. And I don't think that'd be a particularly good way for the film to go. But so I'm going to tentatively hug this.
Hug.
I'm going to challenge your tentative. The reason we watch movies is to see what they're going to do with it, and we may not ultimately like it at the end, but this is a question of whether we're going to see the movie or not, not whether we're going to like the movie or not.
Fair enough. I'm sticking with tentative.
Bah. But also, something you said, that's why they often say sci-fi fantasy together, because it is a very sci-fi premise where you change one thing about the way the world is constructed scientifically, but this is just changing one thing about the way the world is created or constructed fantastically.
William?
Yeah, this is definitely in the genre of let's take an artist's music and turn it into a movie. I actually, kind of liked Bohemian Rhapsody, so I have a feeling I'd kind of like this as well. But this is definitely a Netflix and hug for me.
Netflix and hug.
Didn't even know that one existed.
Yeah,
you didn't know that one existed? Oh, I've got them all.
He's deep into the drops.
Yeah. He's in the drop zone.
I'm in the drop zone. It's like the danger zone, only better.
Final trailer.
Long Shot is the latest movie from Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. And for me, it seemed like a return to what they're really, really good at. It's the kind of movies that were really popular about 10 years ago and were doing really well and were really sort of innovative on the market but moved away from. It's about Seth Rogen as a writer. I guess he's supposed to be talented. And he ends up finding out his old babysitter. I don't know if he finds it out, but we find out his old babysitter is almost the president of the United States. And she brings him on as a writer. And then there seems to be a romance developing between the two. I love Seth Rogen. I love these kind of movies. I'm in. I think this is going to be really good. Hug.
Hug.
Started off arms folded, skeptical, sour-faced. As I do with a lot of these movies now. It seemed stupid. But about, a third of the way through, I started openly laughing. And then my wife comes in from the other room, and then she's watching the rest of the trailer, and she's laughing. So it really won me over. I would say that, if anything, the trailer accomplished its job of making this thing that otherwise may not be interesting to me look interesting. So well done there. Hug.
Hug.
I agree with you on that, Daniel. One of the things I didn't like before I saw the trailer, and it's one line in the trailer, is they were trying to say, like, this was a reverse Pretty Woman. And, like, I fucking hate the movie Pretty Woman. And a reverse of it, like, that seems even worse. So I was like, oh, God, this is going to be terrible. But the trailer actually showed what it's about, not this stupid marketing ploy of the reverse Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
William?
Yeah, I was with you guys. I you know, my bar for comedies is pretty high. I didn't really know where we were going at the beginning of the trailer, but it kind of brought me in. So I'm gonna tentatively hug this one.
Hug?
All right, that brings us to the end of Trailer Takedown, and things trended upwards in that Trailer Takedown. So unfortunately, as we move forward in this episode, we're gonna have to go down a little bit in Life on the Midside. This week, I was at work in the morning and I received a text message from Daniel, and he sent me like a random article. And then things got really, really sad. So one of our biggest Midsiders out there, very supportive, very active on social media, Midsider Ronnie, this article was about his adopted son who apparently passed away at the age of 13 years old. And it was just completely random for us, Daniel, for you and I, because obviously we have no idea what goes on in the private life of you Midsiders out there. And it sort of, I know it hit you pretty hard, Daniel, and it hit me pretty hard too, because it was just sort of like, Ronnie's a great guy. Just, you can tell by the fact that he listens to the show. I know, but you can tell by the way he the things he says and the way he interacts and how benevolent he is. And, you know, all the articles and information I've read since about what happened and about their life, you can just tell he's a great guy, and he doesn't deserve something like this to happen. So it makes me reflect on sort of the injustice of the randomness of the world. And it really makes me think of, I believe it's something I've mentioned on this show before. I'm sure it's something I did because I talk about it all the time. It really makes me think of something Dr. Drew talks about where, you know, people say, oh, well, how do you be an atheist and do the 12-step program? Well, the higher power thing is not about there being a God. It's just recognizing that we do not control the universe and we do not control everything. And some things are just outside of our control. And this is one of those things that's outside of our control. So sort of what I wanted to reflect on is sort of, you know, I just gave my little like experience as far as learning about this and everything. And I'm sure Daniel, you can do that next, but also sort of how do you cope with these things being out of your control when something so tragic happens to you like this?
Yeah, it's hard, certainly, and admitting that it's hard is important, and understanding that no one is built to deal with this, and I think there's a reason for that, but I'll get to that in a second. So I learned about this, I was late going into work, took a morning off to run some errands, and was heading in late, and was reading about this on Facebook, and pretty much lost it on the metro, which is a weird place to lose it. Wasn't during rush hour, which is probably for the best, but to the point where people were coming up to me and like making sure that I was okay. And that was strange, but some interesting human benevolence there, which was nice to see from the DC area. But overall, you know, we don't emotionally adjust to things immediately. Our emotions tend to, if I think we're properly interacting with the world, they follow from our values and the things we care about and the way we order our lives, but they certainly do not immediately follow from the way we order our lives or our values. And so we can't just command our emotions to be what we want them to be. And that's, I think, for a particular reason, which is that if our emotions followed immediately from the things we decide are valuable or followed immediately from that which we decided to be rational, we would be emotional roller coasters sometimes on a second-by-second basis, because we don't come to things even though we come to things rashly, that doesn't mean we come to them orderly. We don't necessarily come to them in an integrated, hierarchical, step-by-step sense in the moment or over a short period of time or even over a mid-range period of time. It takes a while to order things for yourself. So that's a very abstract way of getting into what I want to talk about and how I deal with it, which is essentially, at the highest level, it is you have to do a lot of work coming to accept the reality of the situation in dealing with randomness or a particular tragedy. I've luckily not had to deal with many in my adult life. The biggest, other than my grandparents passing, which is something everyone has to deal with when they're some youngish age. But I had a cousin who died when I was in sixth grade. He was a cousin I looked up to very much. He died of leukemia, and it was very unjust. It was very much he had all the potential in the world. He was in the military, and he was a computer developer, and he helped develop the first device that allowed people to connect to the internet over a mobile phone. This is when I was in the sixth grade. He was working on this, so it was really revolutionary stuff. And the way anyone has to deal with it, the way I dealt with it, is taking a long time to settle with the reality of the situation, that this person is gone, that you will not be seeing them again, that there's no more interaction here. And I learned really early on that part of what that meant was not trying to suppress whatever emotions I was feeling about the given thing, but allowing myself to feel those emotions very openly and very, very harshly. In a certain sense, you know, not trying to suppress them, not trying to make them any less than what they were, but feeling exactly what it was that I was feeling and allowing myself to feel that. And sometimes that meant me laying on a bed or wherever and crying for hours at a time. And then sort of after those emotional fits or emotional periods would pass, sort of trying to intellectualize what this was and the reality of the situation. So I've used that model, and that's not a very precise step-by-step thing I know, but use that model to deal with tragedy. So anyone else?
Yeah, Daniel, you kind of touched on the benevolence of others aspect. And for me, that's really how I've dealt with tragedy in my past. Is I tend to lean more on those relationships I have with people that know me the best, that you know, that can really see me as a person. Because I know for me, dealing, understanding where my emotions are coming from is a hard skill for me. And so having someone that I can try to talk out how I'm feeling and dealing with that is something that I know that I need in moments like this. So I guess the only thing I'm adding is that it's very individualized to who you are and to how best to deal with this and rely on your friends. Or random strangers, in case you're on the DC Metro, to do that, because people have sympathy with this, right? And empathy, right? Almost everyone has experienced some kind of tragedy that they can connect to you on, and they can help you talk through the immense psychological baggage that you need to work through.
Or your favorite podcast hosts.
That's true.
Yeah. Listening to things that you value.
Well, that's part of why I did this, because I wanted to show support. And, you know, I posted the links on Facebook and Twitter. There's a Patreon, not Patreon, sorry, PayPal. All these P's where you give money. There's a PayPal where you can give money to Ronnie's family to help them in this time. And, I wanted to do more than that, because it's important to support more than financially. I think a lot of people would just be like, oh yeah, throw some money at them, send them some flowers, and it's all okay. And like, I think it misses exactly what William just said, the other value you can provide to people, which is that you are another human being. So that's part of why I wanted to do this segment. But also, I think, Daniel, what you said is very well taken and needs to be underscored, is not to let the feelings you're feeling guide your intellectual understanding of what happened. Because if you're not separating those two, then you could very easily just let the emotions overtake you to the point that you're not thinking properly, which then reinforces these unhealthy thought processes, which continue throughout life. And then you would later have to do work to undo them. It's sort of like rehabbing an injury. If you don't rehab it right, you're going to be messed up physically, which is going to mess up other parts of your body. And then you're going to have to undo all that work. It's going to be a harder process later on. So I think, it's really important to make time to feel what you're going to feel and then not try to intellectualize things when you're feeling on that deep of intense of a level. And then also to when you have the time and the ability to think about things at that point and maybe even develop a process where you know when those two things are going to happen on some predictive level. Now, that's what can be tough about a tragedy is these emotions come out of nowhere, even when you don't realize it. Something small can set you off.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it should not go without saying that if you have difficulty with this, or even if you don't and you just want help, please absolutely seek help. Yes, be it from friends, as William said. Friends are fantastic in these kind of situations. But seek out professional help. See a therapist. Talk to someone who deals with grief and trauma. And especially if there's something where you are sort of following what you consider to be the right method of dealing with grief, and it won't subside. The heightened emotions won't subside. That tends to be a signal that there's something deeper of a problem, and you should absolutely seek help of a therapist, just as you would if you broke your leg and you were like, no, forget it, I got this, and you just continue to try to run marathons on a broken leg. You should consult a doctor in both cases, to be clear.
Well, what's interesting about that is it's common that if you hurt yourself to a certain degree, like if you blow out your ACL, no one's ever like, oh yeah, you don't need to see a physical therapist. But if like you go through an immense tragedy, people are like, oh yeah, you don't need to go to see a mental therapist. So it's really interesting the dichotomy we have of that in our society, where one is just taken for granted and the other it's like discouraged.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
All right. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to add to this segment before we end it?
No, well, obviously we are sending our love to Midsider Ronnie and his family. And it often comes off as a cliche. So I try to find different ways to say it, but it's things like, you know, if there's any way, you know, anyone on the show can relieve a burden for you, Midsider Ronnie, or the cliched way of saying it is help out in any way, you know, please reach out. We'd be more than happy to do so, but I mean it very sincerely, in the most sincere way I can possibly convey it.
Yeah, and the way I convey it sincerely is to do something like this, because I would rather just try and do something. And, you know, if you need something else, you can tell me. But this is the best that I have to offer for you, Ronnie. So hopefully this helps you in this terrible time for you.
Yep, we're here for you, bro.
All right, guys. What did we learn this trip? William?
Well, after that life on the Midside, it's hard to go back to my joke for what have we learned this trip. But
do it for Roddy.
All right. Well, I learned that I've declared a national emergency here in California because there's too much rain, and we're going to pump lots of global warming gases into the atmosphere to stop this rain.
Wait, I thought you guys were in a state of perpetual drought.
Oh, no, they tried that, though. There's an article
forever drought
this week where they were like, no, they said that. They were like, oh, you know, the rain's great, but I know we're in a really rainy season, but don't think that means the drought has gone away. And I was like, really?
Meanwhile, the L.A. River, like, there's no homeless now in the L.A. River because they've all washed away.
Yeah, and they're like, everything's flooding and they're shutting down highways and stuff. Yeah, it's – but there's still a drought.
Yeah, the forever drought.
Daniel?
I learned that there are even fewer reasons for me to go to baseball games now that they're going to start banning peanuts and Cracker Jacks. You know, they should start banning is a boring-ass sport. That's really what they should start banning.
Should go to hockey games instead, speaking of Ronnie. Hockey is really fun to go to live.
Yeah.
I would love to go to live. I have a really hard time watching it on TV because I am one of those people who just goes, I don't know where the puck is. I can't.
No, it's so much better live. It's so much better. It's one of those things like, you know, football is a different experience live than on television, yeah. But it's, you know, it's equally fun probably in both, but in much different ways. Hockey is just so much better live.
Yeah. I wish I could get hockey tickets here. It's impossible because our team is good. So, Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned a lot about national emergencies and all of the 4D chess and everything. I didn't know any of this was going on this level. I was just like, oh, yeah, of course he wants to build the wall because he said he would, blah, blah, blah. But all this 4D chess stuff is like, I thought that was just on Star Trek The Next Generation 4D chess.
Oh, no, my friends. 4D chess is what our president is playing at all time because he's a mega genius. Wah, 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 wah. Terrible. Okay.
He plays 5D chess, Daniel.
That's right. We're gonna up that number until it's a 2020 D chess, but
no, until it's 69 chess, and then he's playing it 69 D chess, and he's playing it with Rob Gronkowski.
God. Well, if you learned something this week, we'd love to hear about it on any of our social media accounts at the Midside. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. Still, I don't know. Vero, Instagram a lot lately, and the Twitters. And tell your friends to follow us. It's important. It helps us get the word out. You can go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the past episodes. I mean, this is season 7, which should indicate that there are, like, a lot of seasons before this that you could go back and listen to if you're so inclined, if you have nothing else to do. Or you can go to those archives on Apple Podcasts or Google Play. And while you're there, subscribing to get the latest content delivered to your listening device, give us a 5-star rating. That really does help us move up the rankings for when people search for things like Welcome to the, you know, Night Vale comes up and Beehive or some other crap comes up. We want Welcome to the Midside to come up. Or you can just search for the Midside and that comes up instantly. But that really helps. We love all of our 5-star reviews. Themidside.com/store for products. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Go Libertarians. And Patreon.com/themidside. That's where you can give a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content. So if we take some time off, you don't give us any money. But the money does help us keep the lights on, particularly the lights that run the internet, i.e. our hosting and domain name services, things like that. So very helpful there. But the most important thing, as we learned throughout the show in various forms, is the fellowship, the Tolkien-esque fellowship that we share here in our effort to destroy the ring of social justice. So if you want to tell a friend about the show, that's probably the absolute best thing you can do. Turn a friend onto this show, turn an enemy onto this show, turn a lover onto this show, and help us reach the masses. So until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Man, the music for this show is really good. You should probably listen to it.
You should probably listen to it once in a while, yeah.
Yeah, it's like I'm good at producing a podcast, Daniel.
I know. I mean, it's like, it should give you credit or something.
And like a true producer, I'm doing all the production, so.
Whoa, hold on. As we've all learned from Hollywood, there's two types of production, okay?
Yes, there's the actual work, and then there's credit for the actual work.
This is season 7. Who did everything for the first 6, assholes?